Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
School's out for winter. We reach a teacher in the Twin Cities where students have moved to virtual learning because children were repeatedly being targeted by ICE. She tells us about the difficult conversations she's having in her online classroom and with her own children.
And Dust to Stardust, a Montreal filmmaker's short documentary about three donkeys' long journey to a high-powered telescope in Chile, is a wordless trek through a desolate landscape. And today it really reached the stars when it was nominated for an Oscar.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. We receive support from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwood since 1930. Patterson's feature clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smart Wool. Patterson'sClothing.com. Minnesota Mixtape is our deep dive into the local music scene, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. with host Malachi Coons. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is a new tune from Sam Henshaw. This song is called Get Back.
Oh,
And that is Get Back by Sam Henshaw.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Driving his points home after a provocative speech at Davos, Mark Carney returns to Canada with a message of unity. A former Trudeau speechwriter tells us if she thinks it hit the mark.
Unceasing fire. Three more journalists are killed in Gaza, adding to a staggering total on one of the deadliest days since the ceasefire began.
Laptop of the class. In Minneapolis, some schools have had to pivot and quickly to online learning. It's to protect students from ICE agents. A teacher tells us she hopes small acts of kindness can counter the fear her students are dealing with.
Working the family line. When production was halted at their plant, a family of auto workers made the difficult decision to move to a city hours away so the whole 18-member strong clan could get back to work together.
Bold questions and bolder questions. We still don't know how dozens of giant stones got to Stonehenge, but thanks to new science, we do know one way they didn't get there.
And ahead of the pack, animals. A Quebec filmmaker talks to us about her Oscar-nominated documentary, which follows a trio of donkeys on a journey to get a glimpse of the cosmos. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that hopes they spotted some asteroids. After an eventful trip abroad speaking to the world, Prime Minister Mark Carney has returned home, and today he spoke directly to Canadians. At La Citadelle in Quebec City, the Prime Minister delivered a sweeping address before meeting with Cabinet ahead of Parliament's return on Monday. In that address, he turned his focus from global affairs to his vision of Canadian national identity.
In a time of rising populism and ethnic nationalism, Canada can show how diversity is a strength, not a weakness. In a time of democratic decline, we can show how rights can be protected and equal freedoms endure. And in a time of rising walls and thickening borders, we can demonstrate how a country can be both open and secure, welcoming and strong, principled and powerful.
Today's address followed a speech at Davos that made headlines around the world, in which the Prime Minister referred to a fading rules-based order. Jenny Armstrong is a former head speechwriter for Justin Trudeau. We reached her in Ottawa.
Jenny, having done the work that you've done, what do you hear Prime Minister Carney trying to do there?
Well, my takeaway when I hear those kinds of phrases is it really struck me as a speech of reassurance, that the message that the Prime Minister wanted to share with Canadians, and I think the message he wanted us all to walk away with, is that there is a path forward. Right. Even though times are difficult, when we pull together, when we work together, we can find a way through.
So what's your sense of whether he was successful or he'll be successful in convincing the audience of that?
That's a fair question. You know, when I really look at this speech, the one that he delivered today in Quebec City, as sort of a bookend to the speech that he gave earlier this week in Davos. And I think it was really remarkable where the speech was given, because he was speaking from the Citadel, which, if I'm remembering my grade 10 history, was itself built to withstand American attacks. But then he'd also talked about, you know, what the government is doing and, you know, some of the trade deals that it's working on and so on. And then he talked, and you heard it in that clip, about what Canadians need to do, right? We need to remember where we came from. We need to stay true to our values. And it was very clear. One of my favorite lines from the remarks today was that our values must be fought for. It was a very clear message to Canadians today.
He did reference the tensions between the United States and Canada. We'll listen to that part together as well.
Canada and the United States have built a remarkable partnership in the economy, in security, and in rich cultural exchange. But Canada doesn't live because of the United States. Canada thrives because we are Canadian.
That line was not actually in the embargoed text version we received earlier. What do you make of the Prime Minister adding that those lines, that direct response to Trump?
Well, I'll just say, in terms of a very human response, that's the point where I was watching it live on TV, where I actually stood up and clapped alone in my living room. So in this instance, I think it was a very clear response to President Trump's comments. And I think it was a fair response. I think the Prime Minister said what many of us are thinking or were thinking when we heard what the President had to say. I mean, my reaction had a few more swear words in it than Prime Minister Carney's did. But I think he is very accurately reflecting the public mood or the public reaction when we hear those sorts of things.
Well, the fact that the American President and the Trump administration are lashing out, pushing back to those comments in Davos and the response it's received internationally suggests that it hit a nerve. Do you think that was the intention?
I can't speak to the intention, but I think that's pretty clearly the effect. The Commerce Secretary, if I'm remembering correctly, described Carney's Davos speech as something like political noise. I'm like, well, but it's political noise you're commenting on, and it's political noise you're being asked about, you know, that world leaders and world media are reflecting on. I guess I would say when it comes to, American reactions to Canadian comments, in particular from the current American administration, are their words full of sound and fury? Yes, quite often. Do they signify anything at all? I guess, time will tell. We'll see what the next, hours, days, weeks, months portend.
In terms of knowing your audience, as you were saying, today was directed at a Canadian audience. Davos, that speech, very different audience. And, you're the Prime Minister quoting Thucydides and Havel. And it's quite a juxtaposition to what we did see and hear from the U.S. president. That's his brand, certainly.
Right.
But understanding that audience and who's taking it in, how important is that to getting the kind of attention and effect that a leader like the Prime Minister of Canada would want in that room?
I think it's absolutely essential because it's sort of at the heart of authenticity when somebody is speaking. Listen, there have been rumors that about the fact that Prime Minister Carney may have held the pen, as we like to say, on his own remarks, both in Davos and perhaps on his Quebec City speech as well. There were so many elements of this speech, and I have not written for him, so I'm a consumer of his speeches, not a producer of them. But there were so many lines that to my ear sounded like what I would call pure Mark Carney, right? Words like plurilateral. There was a line that said, complementarities are positive sum. Those are not the sort of things that speech writers will usually put into a speech. They're the sort of things that a speaker will put into the speech. And while I don't think those kinds of words would have worked well, for the broadcast we saw today, where it's a broad Canadian audience, I do think they were appropriate for the kinds of folks who are in the room in Switzerland.
And so when you're a speechwriter and you have speeches that are delivered by the person you're working for hit a nerve like this, go well, you're building on this day after day, what needs to happen after those speeches are delivered to then get the kind of unity and the strength in practice that the Prime Minister is pushing for?
Well, I think, I know that the opposition party or opposition parties have been critical of the fact that, these are words, but we need to start to see some action. I do think the Prime Minister made a pretty compelling case, both in Davos and today in Quebec City, for the actions that the government has taken in the last, 6 or 8 months. But that is really where the rubber meets the road, right? I think we're going to need to see programs stood up. We're going to need to see new trade deals struck. We're going to see new jobs created to offer the kind of reassurance that Canadians are looking for right now.
Jenny, I'm glad we could speak. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jenny Armstrong is an associate professor in Carleton's political management program and a former speechwriter for Justin Trudeau. We reached her in Ottawa. 3,000 agents from ICE and Customs and Border Patrol are creating a climate of fear in Minnesota. And now schools are doing something to ease that fear. This morning, some 6,000 students in St. Paul moved to virtual learning. A lot of young people there are reluctant to attend school in person, afraid they'll be apprehended. And as you heard on last night's program, educators are especially concerned about ICE's detention of 5-year-old Liam Conejo Ramos, who was taken from his home in a Minneapolis suburb on Tuesday. At a press conference yesterday, school officials said he's one of at least 4 children from the school district who've been detained this month. Amy Hewitt Olatunde is a middle and high school ESL teacher in St. Paul. That's where we reached her.
Amy, I know you've taught virtually before, but to start back in a virtual classroom today, what was that like?
It was a little bit of a different energy. Reminded me a little bit of when we returned from COVID, but obviously for different reasons. The classroom was a lot emptier, not only for myself, but people across the district and also in other districts that have also switched over to a hybrid environment because we are doing virtual and we're also teaching the students that are coming in person as well.
When was that decision made to do this starting today, moving these students?
That decision was made late last week, and then we were given yesterday and the day before Tuesday and Wednesday to put together online virtual plans for those students.
So things happen very quickly, and what is happening on the ground, in these communities is certainly happening very quickly. How do you feel about how things have escalated around you?
Best word I can use is unfathomable. Nothing I ever thought I'd see in my lifetime. Nothing I ever thought that my children would see and my students would see. So it is rapidly increasing with the number of people being detained indiscriminately based on nothing more than skin color or accent. It doesn't matter if you are an adult, if you are a child. We're trying to pull together as people living here to find solidarity and protest and rally and do grocery runs and all those things that we think we can do to support those that are in the most need right now.
So much has happened. What was the thing, the moment that made the school and the school district make that decision?
I think I would say last week what really changed is when I started going door to door, knocking door to door and entering homes. And also it was that they started detaining and pulling over teenagers. That was when things really took a turning point for how volatile things have become. And they were volatile before, but now they're also coming into school parking lots. They're detaining some teachers. So it's really gotten quite out of hand. And I say that very lightly.
The St. Paul Public Schools District backed up what you were just saying there, that transport vans full of teachers and students were pulled over by ICE. The students you work with, what are they and their parents telling you?
There is a very real fear. Students are very scared. Whether we receive an email from a student saying, I don't know what to do right now, my family's scared, to even my own children, my own 2 children, my oldest is very scared and is afraid to even go to work as a person of color. There's just a lot of confusion. I'm going to be honest with you. Confusion of why are they doing this to kids? Why are they breaking apart families? I thought this was safe. And now that it's kind of getting closer to our schools, that becomes even more threatening.
How do you allay their fears or try to, at least, before you could, at least you were in the classroom and face to face, now virtually, students may log on, they may not. How do you calm those concerns?
I'm a very overly affectionate human in terms of just verbal affirmations. I tell them I love them. I'm here to support them. I also ask them if they need resources, groceries for their families, just to have someone to talk to. And shooting an email to them or making a phone call to them just so that they know that we're thinking of them. Does that really calm their nerves when they're at home and hiding inside, hoping that no one knocks on their door? Probably not. But we're in such an unforeseen situation right now. So we're just trying to do our best as humans to support other humans right now.
You're a dual citizen, Canadian and American, but you've lived in Minnesota for many, many years. What are you thinking? How are you thinking about where you have called home?
When I go home, and I refer to home as Manitoba, my friends and just people in the community will often ask, why don't you just move back here? And, you know, that would be very easy to do. But I also have been working in the cities for 30 years and I've planted my life here with my children and I'm not returning anytime soon. I'm here to do the work that's needed to work for and support people in this community.
And what do you tell Canadians who say they want to come to where you are?
I would say now's not a good time. Generally speaking, if this wasn't happening, Minnesota is an absolutely beautiful place to come. But I'd say right now is not a good time. What you're seeing on the news internationally is but a small portion of what is actually happening here. And I think for people that live here, I mean, I live and work in St. Paul, Minneapolis. And, you know, if someone knocks on your door, you're scared. As a parent, you wake up many times throughout the night, just kind of alert. And that's the reality of the way things are right now.
You mentioned your children, 18 years old and 14 years old. He talks about their concerns. What do you tell them? How do you equip them for the world they're living in right now?
So with my 18-year-old, they are very politically driven, but they're also very fearful. I'm constantly checking their location. I've told both my children that if I call them, they are meant to call me right back or answer the phone. There can be no hesitation regardless of what they're doing. My 14-year-old, you know, is having a little bit of a harder grasp of what's going on and the urgency of it just because he hasn't seen any ICE trucks or ICE vehicles, fortunately. But I do send him when teenagers are detained or arrested, I will tell him and I will send him the video because I want him to understand how serious this is, that he is not allowed to go outside and go sledding or skating. When we're at home, the shades are drawn and the door is locked. You know, we shouldn't be afraid of doing that. But my kids are kids of color. That puts an extra threat for them that I don't necessarily have. And even myself, who knows if I could be detained for something, right? They're not really picking and choosing so selectively.
Amy, I appreciate this. Thank you for the time and take care.
Thanks very much. I appreciate your time.
Amy Hewitt Olatunde is a middle school and high school teacher of ESL in St. Paul, Minnesota. That's where we reached her. The Oscar nominations were announced this morning, as you probably know, and in a few cases, it seems like voters were seduced by pure star power. But the Academy members who voted to nominate the film Perfectly Estrangeness for Best Short Documentary were captivated by some very different stars, a trio of donkeys and the actual stars, the ones in the sky. The oddly beautiful, wordless film follows the three creatures as they clomp across a desolate, ancient-seeming landscape, winding their way up hills to a jarringly futuristic facility with gleaming white-domed buildings dotting a mountaintop. As night falls, this is revealed to be a Chilean observatory, home to high-powered planet-finding telescopes. Alison McAlpin is the Canadian director of Perfectly Estrangeness. We reached her in Montreal.
Alison, was this a case of you watching the nominations and then hearing that your film was nominated for an Academy Award, or was this a case of you get a call early in the morning from someone in your team?
No, I watched it. It was fun. I watched it. I was with my lovely Chilean editor, and we were watching it. Well, we were talking together by Zoom. And watching it, she was, I think, watching it on her computer. I was watching it on my phone. And so it's lovely to share that and the nervousness. And and then when we heard the news, we both leapt. And she in Santiago, Chile, me, and I was in Montreal in my place.
What a perfect moment, and a perfect moment in 2026, how you describe it.
Yes.
The connections around the world.
It was really lovely. It was the last film. I mean, they do it alphabetically, right? But it was the last film, and it's a complete, a wonderful surprise and honor.
There's been a lot of great press for your film. It played the festival circuit. It is experiential. I just watched it. It's quite moving and beautiful. But it's not the typical thing people might think might get nominated. Maybe they should think absolutely. It would. But in the past, perhaps. So were you surprised that it connected with Academy voters in this way?
Well, yeah, I've been wonderfully. I mean, I've never done anything like this before, never even contemplated this. But the film won an Oscar qualifying award, and filmmakers that I really respect encouraged me to do this whole campaign. It was also nominated for an important American award called Cinema Eye Honors. And yeah, I resisted a lot, but I was surprised. I just thought this film is just too experimental. It's not a journalistic doc, right, with an issue. So, but anyway, filmmakers that I really respect said, you should do this. And I've been really moved by how many Oscar members, who are the voters, of course, who have come up to me or written me and said that how much they love the film. So that was, I was really touched. I've been very touched and by emails I've received. So there is an openness to, because most of the other films are very journalistic, more politically oriented documentaries, and which are important too. But I was it's wonderful to feel that there's space for other ways to tell a story.
I mean, all that feedback, those comments you're getting, that's, of course, an Oscar is another thing altogether, but that kind of respect and love from your peers must feel like an incredible success and a win in and of itself.
Yes. Yeah, enormously. I mean, I really felt so many of these events had also a wonderful, warm community feeling. I met so many international filmmakers. So, you know, it was actually authentically very, very warm as well.
How did you come to make the film?
One thing that fascinated me was that at this observatory where we film with donkeys, there are often many donkeys there. And there are, I think, some domestic, some wild. And they're just amongst these big, huge, very expensive metal beasts, you know, giants, these domes and telescopes. And that juxtaposition fascinated me. So I just asked a simple question. How do these donkeys see this world, you know, how do they see the universe, really? So that was my one starting point, and then explored, of course, lenses, anamorphic lenses to approximate their near panoramic vision. And I spoke with scientists and much exploration on with sound too. I wanted to make a film without any text. And so really from the real perspective, exploring how a donkey would see this world. And I walked amongst these domes, and I felt like the observatory was alive because of the sounds they make, you know, these metal domes that are brilliant in the sun, and they're shining, and they make these groans and breaths, et cetera, and metallic clanging, et cetera. These beasts, these metallic beasts, are like asleep by day, and then when the sun goes down, they open their eyes open to the universe, and they chase the stars all night, and they dance, which of course we pushed in the film, but they dance, and then when the dawn arrives again, they fold up their eyes and they go to sleep again. So I wanted to create this kind of fantastic tale that happened in 24 hours.
Where you shot this, there's no light pollution. So to be in that environment, to be under those stars and looking up at that night sky, you're working, yes, but what was that like?
Oh, it's extraordinary. It's really so beautiful that you want to touch the sky. I mean, it's so, and I felt inside the sky for the first time in Chile, not below the sky. You know, you feel it viscerally, or you can feel it viscerally if you go into more isolated areas. The sky is so alive, which is why there's many avistamientos, which are, you know, sightings of UFOs, etc. People talk about it in the city or the country or whatnot, but the sky is very, very alive. And so it changes color. It changes your perspective of the world, when you feel yourself inside the universe in a way, at least that I never felt before.
A pleasure speaking with you, Allison. Thank you for this, and congratulations on the nomination.
Okay, thank you very much. Cheers.
Allison McAlpin is the director of the film Perfectly Estrangeness, which was nominated today for Best Documentary Short at the Academy Awards. We reached her in Montreal. For centuries, people have gazed upon the majesty of Stonehenge and asked themselves, who built this? How did they build it? Why? What's it for? Did I already ask who? I did? Are you sure? And stuff like that.
They ask the age-old questions about this mysterious monument. Who built it? How was it built? And why?
For generations, people have argued over its origin, its meaning, and its purpose.
Why was Stonehenge built in southwest England 5,000 years ago? And what was it used for?
Why is it here? What's it for? How was it built?
Today, an enduring mystery that leaves us asking, who came to this vast monument, and what did they do here?
Don't ask me. I don't know. I mean, look, I know it was designed to be a place to observe the course of the sun and the changing of the seasons. And when we reflect on those ancient people gathered at that sacred place to mark the solstice, we can only pause and think, that must have been so boring. We also know the stones came from a nearby quarry, from Wales and from Scotland. But almost none of the stones could have fit in ancient pockets, so we don't know how they got there. But we now know how they didn't get there. Glaciers. Scientists analyzed hundreds of zircon crystals from the rivers around Stonehenge. These crystals are smaller than grains of salt, but don't mistake them for salt because they don't taste like anything. Anyway, if glaciers had deposited the giant stones at the Stonehenge site, some evidence of the land they'd been dragged across would have shown up in these zircon crystals, but none did. So glaciers were not involved. Now, what's most impressive about this is that people are always asking,
who built it? What's it for?
Why did they build it here?
How was it built?
What was it used for?
And what did they do here?
But no one asks, did glaciers do something? So for once, someone asked an original Stonehenge question, a genuinely monumental achievement. Now here's Partner with Rock Is My Rock.
My dream, but rock's not as simple as it may seem, cause
you gotta be honest all the time, so it's gotta be true, and also has to rhyme.
But I don't care if it's on the way to the top, I'm gonna get there, cause rock is my rock. Rock is my rock. Rock is my rock. Rock is my rock. Rock is my rock.
The guy we met in Cleveland and his brother too, rock is their rock, I bet they tell you.
And just his dad and some on TV, rock is a rock, as you can see.
Oh, rock is a rock. Rock is a rock. Rock is a rock. Rock is a rock. I listen to rock and I stay inside.
It's a warm, safe place for a high eyes.
So when I am 50
and I'm 52,
I hope I'm still rocking.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, a strong sense of direction, we will remember Gladys West, whose math made GPS possible. Her friend tells us about the brilliant mathematician whose work went largely overlooked.
And you won't believe your ears. You better not. After he repeatedly mixed up Iceland and Greenland in his long and rambling Davos speech, Donald Trump's press secretary insists, no, he didn't. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
You're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew Dzingel. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer hosts, Alyssa Ellen. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic, introducing Abby Spare to their team at both locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, performing routine eye exams, assisting with post-op care after surgery, and more. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Do you rely on KAXE? Are you at least 70 and a half years old? Supporting KAXE's future is easy. ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to KAXE. Questions? Call Sarah at 218-326-1234. Looking at weather tonight, partly cloudy with a chance of flurries, lows 27 to 31 below. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and cold with daytime highs 11 to 16 below. Now back to As It Happens.
Three more names have been added to the list of journalists who've been killed in Gaza. Yesterday, Mohammed Kushtam, Anas Ghanem, and Abdel Rauf Shat were working for the media arm of a relief group run by the Egyptian government when their car was targeted by an Israeli airstrike. The Israel Defense Forces issued a statement saying their members had observed, quote, several suspects who operated a drone affiliated with Hamas in the central Gaza Strip in a manner that posed a threat to their safety, unquote. The military did not respond to questions about how it determined the drone was affiliated with Hamas. The journalists were among 11 Palestinians killed by Israeli forces yesterday. Since the start of the war, the Committee to Protect Journalists has recorded that Israeli fire in Gaza has killed at least 206 journalists and media workers. The military says it has targeted only combatants. Shourouk Assad is a spokesperson for the Palestinian Journalists Syndicate. We reached her in Ramallah.
Shourouk, you knew one of the journalists who were killed. Tell us a little bit about Mohammed.
I knew Mohammed from far away because I cannot, I'm banned from entering Gaza like so many journalists, foreign and even from West Bank. He's young, very dedicated, very polite. I contacted him once because I was trying to help my female journalist colleagues. I have a group like around 300 of them. And we were trying to deliver beginning of first during the starvation, flour, if they can help me in flour, because he also films a little bit for the Egyptian humanitarian committee. And so he knows some access sometimes for things to help them, like covers, like blankets or tents or so on. So from time to time, I used to talk to him to maybe exchange, I can give him some info or numbers, he can give me some numbers. And we were talking just about how can we really help our colleagues out to make things better in their daily life.
When you did message with Mohammed and all of, you know, your colleagues in the syndicate that you work with, how do they express how they're feeling, whether they're afraid as they continue to do this work? I mean, was he, as young as he was, preparing for something like this?
No, but I remember once we've been talking about things. Actually, this is a word that he repeats, and so many of my colleagues say, that they say usually at the end of any call, okay, but if I don't answer, the phones may, I don't know if I will be alive tomorrow or not. This is a word that everybody repeats in Gaza, because really you don't know if next minute they will be alive or not. He was sad, he was traumatized, he was afraid, but he never felt he's doing anything that can make him a target. He never felt this way. And especially lately, he was focusing a lot on the displaced people and families and filming them and working with them and working in the camps of the civilians and the displaced people. And that's how he was killed anyway. He was in an area with Abed and the other colleague, Anas Ghanem. They weren't on a border. They are in Gaza City. It was East Gaza, near Netzarim. It's not any of the areas where they were indicated, if people can hear us, after Trump made the ceasefire. They drew on a map of Gaza zones. Red zone, nobody can get to it. Yellow zone, it's safer. He was even not in the yellow. He was in the safest zone.
The relief agency the journalists were working with said they were using a drone to photograph a tent camp last week as part of their work. In terms of what happened this week, the Israeli military says, as our listeners heard, that the journalists were operating a drone affiliated with Hamas. What do you make of that explanation?
For me, this is only an excuse. They are known they are journalists. They are known what they are doing. And anyway, you have to know, Israel really, really well equipped. They know exactly who they bomb. This is a message for me that we don't want any narrative other than the Israeli narrative. We want you to stay afraid and terrorized. We want to silence you. And we don't want any people to have any testimony on all the crimes. And traumatizing journalists again and again and again. This affiliation of there was nothing on the street. There's no militants, no clash, no nothing at all.
The journalists were among 11 people killed. For you, when you hear ceasefire now, given what has happened just yesterday, what does that mean for you and the future there?
There wasn't any minute ceasefire, and I'm in contact, and I have family in Gaza that I lost so many of them. I have colleagues, I talk to them every day, and I am a journalist. There is no ceasefire. Israel wants to keep occupying Gaza. This is clear for everybody. There is, okay, a ceasefire, maybe in the news, in the headlines, but in the daily lives, ceasefire means safety. Ceasefire means protection. Ceasefire means that I have to find milk for my children, and I have to have dignity and to have a roof on my top, and even to have medication and to be... No, there isn't.
In terms of the journalists, your colleagues, the funerals were held. What, if anything, is being done to support their families now?
The people, today I called a colleague. They said they will be visiting and helping them and so on. But what will really give them back what the loved ones they lost? Nothing will bring them back. It's just a soldier who decided to click on a button and just end the life of young journalists. And I don't think anything will really get back all the loved ones and all the destruction that happened. But the only thing that should be done is accountability. I don't know what I tell you, being a journalist in Palestine or in Gaza is becoming as if a crime, and becoming as if we have always to really defend ourselves, that we are journalists, we are good journalists. Even the international organizations depend on our news. I think if Israel really, really get accountable or punished, maybe they will think hundreds of times before they kill a journalist. If this happens in Canada or Israel or Paris or Ukraine, we would have seen different reaction from the world.
Shuruk, I appreciate this. Thank you, and please take care.
Thank you.
Shuruk Assad is a spokesperson for the Palestinian Journalists Syndicate. We reached her in Ramallah. For the Jacildos, the Stellantis plant in Brampton, Ontario, is like a family business. Joseph Jacildo has worked at the auto plant for nearly 28 years. Eventually, his wife joined him, and when they were old enough, so did his three daughters and then their partners. In total, 8 members of the Jacildo family get their paychecks from the company. So 2 years ago, when the Brampton plant temporarily paused production to pivot to EVs, the family had a choice to make. As the pause dragged on, they decided to accept a transfer to Stellantis' Windsor assembly plant. So the family of 18, including 10 grandchildren, packed up their lives and moved 3 hours west. Jasmine Jacildo described how difficult that decision was and what it's like to work with her entire family.
It's nice in the aspect that we understand what we're talking about when we do want to, vent about work. But at the same time, it is scary because if Brampton does close, we would prefer to live there. That's where we grew up. That's where we were all, that's where we all started. But if that were to go away, you have no clue what else is going to happen with the auto industry in Canada. And then we would have no job. And we've been working there for quite a bit, where we're at that age that it's harder and harder to get jobs that pay as much as we get right now, right? We've been very lucky with the fact that, you know, that we do get paid as much as we do. We get our benefits, we get RSP and everything like that. But if that were to go away, then I have no clue what we would really do. We decided when they announced that our Jeep Compass was getting moved to the States, that's when we decided for sure that we were going to make the transition. So we were able to take a couple months, like 2 or 3 months, to actually transition into this. A lot of people weren't able to do that, right? A lot of people decided in November. But yeah, it was a very difficult transition, that's for sure.
When they took out the Charger, the Challenger and the 300, and then they said they're going to bring it to Windsor, that's the time I was so mad, but I can't do nothing.
In that case, it would be partially the company and the government, right? Because, you know, they decided that EVs were going to be the future, and then Brampton isn't equipped for that, and Windsor is. When we were told about the retooling, we were under the impression that it would be maybe a couple years, and then that was it, which is why we were not happy about the decision of them moving our cars to Windsor. But, you know, there's nothing we can really do. We're just line workers, right? We hoped that the union would fight back on it a little bit more, but I think they were also trusting the company in a way where they would make a good decision. Those three cars, we sold a lot of them, which is why we were working 6 days a week and lots of overtime. And, you know, they made that decision, I guess, based on whatever they thought was going to be right at the time.
Jasmine Gisildo and her father Joseph telling CBC Windsor reporter Acton Clarkin about moving their family of 18 to Windsor, Ontario, after the Stellantis assembly plant in Brampton stopped production. Yesterday, after President Trump's speech at the World Economic Forum, Libby Dean of the American cable news outlet News Nation posted on social media, quote, "During his WEF remarks, President Trump appeared to mix up Greenland and Iceland around three times," unquote. She's referring to these moments in his meandering speech when the president said this.
"Till the last few days when I told them about Iceland, they loved me."
And this.
"They're not there for us on Iceland, that I can tell you."
And this.
"You know, stock market took the first dip yesterday because of Iceland."
And this.
"So Iceland's already cost us a lot of money."
But White House spokesperson Caroline Levitt wants you and Libby Dean to know that you and she did not hear what you and she just heard. On Twitter, Ms. Levitt indignantly wrote, quote, "No, he didn't, Libby. His written remarks referred to Greenland as a piece of ice, because that's what it is. You're the only one mixing anything up here," unquote. Whether you're using your phone for driving directions, tracking a delivery, or just trying not to get lost on a hike, the GPS is there to guide you. And it exists in large part because of Gladys West, a mathematician whose calculations helped make GPS possible. Ms. West died last weekend. She was 95 years old. She grew up in segregated Virginia during the Jim Crow era, and in 1956, she beat the odds and became the second black woman hired at a U.S. naval base in Dahlgren, Virginia, one of only four black employees, period. Here's Gladys West speaking at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture in 2021 about the attitude that made her remarkable career possible.
Start by being the right person yourself and then work with others, be respectful, be committed, sort of help others and be a mentor to others. You have a whole lot that you can sort of like give to others yourself without having to expect so much. Sometimes we go to a job and we just expect everything from everybody else, but not from yourself.
Jane Plitt worked for years to bring Gladys West's contributions into public view. She is the founder of the National Center for Women's Innovations in Alexandria, Virginia. We reached her in New York City.
Jane, does that sound like the Gladys West you know so well?
It sounds like the Gladys West who transformed her life, yes.
Did Gladys West grasp fully the enormity of what she had accomplished, how transformative her work had become?
Only she could probably answer that, but my sense is she did, because what she accomplished was not something that she could turn around in a day or a minute, but it took an enormous amount of grit, of perfection, to truly exactly map the world. And as she helped us discover, the world is not a perfect hemisphere. And it's this geoid, and I'm not a scientist, but what she was able to do precisely, not approximately, enabled us, all of us, to be able to get to wherever we want to get to.
Did she ever pat herself on the back about it in her chats with you?
No. Dr. West was a very understated person. Her eyes would twinkle when she saw the exhibit and the enormously warm reception at the National Center of Women's Innovations gala for her. But she was a woman of great humility. And as her grandson, Andre, said, Dr. West was committed to doing her best always, and her best changed the world.
Our listeners heard a little bit about where she was working, the time she was working as a Black woman. What kinds of things was she facing during her time at that Virginia Naval Base? What did she tell you about that experience?
Well, she was hired as the fourth Black professional at the Dahlgren Naval Base in 1956, and she would have been the second Black female. The four Black people could only go outside of the campus when they stuck together, and they would never go out on a weekend for fear of what might happen to them. On the campus, from what she wrote and described, there was acceptance. But her hiring and the hiring of the three other Black professionals needs to be cited as an example of how a brave white male manager chose to break the color barrier and hire the best. And in this day and age, when we're hearing diminishment of what people of color or women are achieving with the suggestion it's only because of DEI, she and her colleagues demonstrated that brain power has nothing to do with race or gender.
Why do you think it's taken so long for more people to know her name, her accomplishments, and her contributions?
I think because she was black and female, and not tooting her own horn, she expected that the results would speak for themselves. But somehow the credit for this enormously powerful system of global positioning that has trillions of dollars of impact on every element of our society, somehow nobody asked who's behind it. And certainly the assumption was not going to be that it was this petite little woman who just did her work.
Our producer spoke to Gladys's daughter, Carolyn, today, and she said that she's proud her mother never stopped learning or trying to improve herself. What did Gladys West teach you?
She personifies the encouragement to every one of us, and especially to me, that perseverance is essential, and that you need to set a dream and pursue it and do the best that you can, accepting that there are going to be unfair obstacles in your way. And you need to seize opportunities and honor your dream. Her dream was to get a PhD, and she was short-circuited because she had several strokes, and at age 70, she fulfilled that dream. I don't know how many of us, I'm past 70, would be willing to hang in there as she did, but it's reflective of her determination.
Extraordinary. Jane, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you for sharing your memories. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
Jane Plitt is the founder of the National Center for Women's Innovations in Alexandria, Virginia, and a family friend of the late Gladys West. We reached her in New York City.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
You are tuned in to 91.